Hey everyone, I've got a trigger warning for you. This episode is violent. You've been warned. Christmas, one and all. I'm Lucas Coleman, and this is California Gothic, and that was our show's Christmas gift from renowned, bound to be renowned pop icon singer-songwriter Kelly Jean Harding. Kelly has been a big fan of the show since we started. She sent us in a song that got rejected from Katy Perry's record. We played it on here. She stayed in touch, writes in every week, and she sent us this lovely email. And if you would allow me, I wanted to read it on the show. Dear Lucas, I was lied to and I need help. If they don't find my body, please play this song for my family. Kelly Jean, you are literally hilarious with your jokes. And I love the song. I take this, my interpretation is that this is just the silliest, most awesome Christmas gift of all time. And the song truly rocks. Side note, we've been trying to get a hold of you to thank you, but your phone keeps going straight to voicemail. So we would love to tell you Merry Christmas in person or Skype. Get in touch. And if you want to hear the rest of that song or more of Kelly Jean's music or any of the music that we feature on California Gothic, you can now check that out on our brand new website. That's www.californiagothicpodcast.com. As you know, tons of artists submit songs and things they want shared on the show. We're happy to post it. And now you can listen to it anytime you'd like through live streaming or download on that new website. You can also check out what's going on or get in touch on our bulletin board and share comments and what you thought about a particular story. Now, I also want to reach out regarding all of you frustrated, aspiring young horror writers out there. If you have these ideas that are literally shredding your brain from the inside of your skull out, and you would like to share that thriving, pulsating, oozing disturbance that's resonating throughout your damaged imagination with the world, you can submit your stories through our website. Just send us a little message about what your story's about, why you find it scary, and what gave you the idea. If we think it's going to be a good fit for our show, we're going to include it in one of our California Gothic episodes. Now, I know there are a few writers out there who have submitted stories to us that we absolutely love and are dying to have us read them on the show. Well, they are coming. Some stories are a bit lengthier than others, and it's just trying to figure out where all the cards fit. But I can tell you, we have some great new voices coming for you in 2022. We've also got some bone-chilling new fiction for you today. But before we get into that, do any of you ever feel like the fun of Halloween is very quickly extinguished? Just gutted when Christmas starts to roll in. It seems like the day after Halloween, Christmas decorations go up. You start having to plan presents, snow, romance, scarves, bad weather, everything that goes along with Christmas time. And it has a way of just really killing the fun of Halloween. We don't even get a wind down cycle. So before we get into today's fiction, I did a quick little list and I discovered that three particular Christmas cliches have their origins in something truly horrific. And I'm going to share those with you right now in a little mini holiday segment I am calling Christmas Carnage. Now, our first horror origin is about the snowman. Now, the snowman in Western culture dates back pretty far, but what we know mostly from snowman is Frosty or holiday jingles. And the contemporary tale of two unsuspecting children that take an old top hat, put it on a snowman's head, and it suddenly animates to life as a person. That on its own is pretty horrific to me when you really step back and think about the concept of it. However, the true origin of the snowman or snowman lore is actually a bit darker and based on a very real-time tragic event. The year was 1637, and in a small Dutch town named, and please excuse me if I mispronounce this because I am not Dutch, but in the Dutch town of Arnhersloot in Northern Holland, a young man named Aljeet Schoenhoven, man, I even pronounced this before I started telling this, but Aljeet was a man of about 20, according to different references, he was somewhere between the age of 23 and 27. And although he was young, Aljeet Schoenhoven was a renowned hat maker. He was said to be very, very fine in his craftsmanship, although it looks like he also dealt with a great overwhelming sense of obsessive compulsive disorder, which is one of the things that led his hats and his craftsmanship to being so perfect. Now, the story goes, someone brought in their old hat, it was sort of the 16th century version of a top hat, so it's not exactly the aristocratic thing that you would know today, but they brought in this form of a top hat, and they just wanted him to redo the lining and restore it and make it sort of polished and newer looking again. They didn't want to get a new hat, and Aljeet saw this hat, and apparently that was the straw that broke the camel's back and sent him into a full-blown episode of schizophrenia. You see, apparently this hat that was brought in at the time was itself an antique, and the stitching was perfect, and it was made with a masterful craftsmanship that Aljeet, I guess in an instant, could never possibly replicate. And he started studying this hat, and it drove him insane. And he got these ideas in his head that the hat must have belonged to a wizard and contain magical properties because it was so superhumanly made. And when he put the hat on his own head, unlike the Frosty the Snowman tale that we know today, where the snowman comes to life, when he put the hat on his head, he believed that he wielded the power of this dark ice wizard, and he turned everyone else in the world into these animated human beings made of soft snow. So what he was seeing from his broken schizophrenic mind was every single human in the world made out of snow. And it made him feel isolated and crazy and go into a panic. Now, you might be thinking, dear God, I hope someone got that man some help. Maybe he spent the rest of his life in an asylum? Well, Dutch culture in the 16th century wasn't quite as woke as we are today. So instead of trying to find him the counseling and help he needed, they decided to hang him in the town square because at the time they were afraid that schizophrenia was contagious and that mankind's mania would spread, ironically, like wildfire through this town. And so they strung him up, but just as an extra cruelty, people found his delusions to be very funny. The Dutch are typically very dark in their humor, and it doesn't get much darker as this. So apparently, as they walked him to the gallows, and I know I'm laughing right now, but it's not funny. Apparently, they filled the town square with actual snowmen so that he would be able to, it would restore him to sanity if what he was seeing was men made of snow, but then they actually put real men actually made of snow, then somehow that would counterbalance with the crazy, and they were replacing delusion with reality, and it would stop insanity from spreading throughout the town. So that sort of, you know, give them what they want, I guess. But they did hang him, and he is dead. So that is the origin of the snowman, or as it's referenced in some of my research, the Sneeuwman. This is almost like a joke how similar they spell it. Sneeuwman. So the Sneeuwman, snowman. I'm probably butchering that, but I really hope not. Wow, what a fun one. Moving on. So our next one, we're going to talk about the quick origin of Rudolph and just reindeer being a Christmas thing in general. So Rudolph is derived from an ancient Germanic name from two stems. Hrud, H-R-U-O-D, meaning fame, glory, the renowned, and wolf, which just about everybody knows what a wolf is. I hesitate to pronounce this. Hofewulfa. Oh man, HR, symbol I don't know, IWULFAZ. But basically this means the legendary wolf, the famous wolf. Now, this has its first reference in the late 1790s in a city named Strasbourg that is situated on the eastern border of France with Germany. This place is also often referred to as the Rhine, R-H-I-N-E. And basically, there was a little village on the German side and a somewhat of a larger castle that was built by a wealthy nobleman on the French side named Klaus Jean. I may be getting that backwards. It may be Jean Klaus. And rumor has it that Klaus was the keeper of champion dogs, hunting dogs. And one day, a couple of children from the German side wandered onto Klaus's property. He did not appreciate their proximity, and he sicked his dogs on the children, which devoured them down to the bone. He would then huck the bones on the other side of this stone wall, which is still there today. Now, when the townsfolk from the German side went to investigate this man's estate, they didn't see the dogs. They saw a family of deer that was sort of picking around this boneyard where he had thrown their children's ribs and skulls and femurs and sort of the remaining parts. And so these people donned the legend of the reindeer that would serve Klaus. And over time, I suppose it became happier and happier, and that person that lived in that northern castle became Santa Claus, and the hounds became reindeer, and they I don't even know how the whole flight thing happens, but that is where you get Rudolph. Now, I've got one more item to add to this list of this year's Christmas carnage, and that is the Advent calendar. Now, this is probably the newest of all of them we have to mention today. The first Advent calendar originated in Germany in the early 20th century with a man named Gerhard Lange. Gerhard was a little boy who lived in Germany with his mother, and they were seeking shelter at a sort of a charitable... You can imagine the winters in Germany get pretty fierce. So they were at sort of a community for women and single mothers to go, and they could seek shelter. And this particular one was in a very old, condemned Catholic church. The church was said to be so old and had problems with termites, and the foundation was not well laid, and it had just become so worn down that it was considered unsafe to use for any kind of mass or church service. But apparently it was okay to house women and children. So when they were in there, there was some sort of seismic reaction or some sort of earthquake, and the church collapsed around them. They were in the crypts of the church, which is where they would keep, you know, around the 18th century, which is when this church was built, they would keep some of the, it was like the morgue. It's where they'd keep the bodies and stuff. And they were down there. They were the only two to survive. And they only had their ration of bread and butter, and that was all they had to eat. So the mother needed to find a way to ration out the food so her child, Gerhard, wouldn't eat it all at once. So she broke the bread up into tiny little pieces, which apparently she broke the bread into 24 pieces, and she built out of some of the shattered morgue stone, the marble that was used in the crypts to house the bodies, she turned them into these little compartments. And every day he got to open another, you know, remove the rubble and have his little piece of bread. And apparently she got to witness this for 23 of the days. And on the 24th day, he had his final piece of bread. By that time, his mother had starved to death. And then on the day after that, he was saved. They pulled him out of the rubble. And he later grew up to come up with the Advent calendar. So now he had them printed, it looks like about 20 years after that, on happy, you know, they were originally carved out of wood. And then it really took off. But it was said to be a reminder of how his mother rationed their food and slowly starved to death in order to preserve him. So, you know, some reminder that was. Now, totally changing gears. The holidays are very often about trying to be not just a good person, but be a better person. And if you consider yourself to be a good person, you have to also acknowledge the fact that that's a choice. Well, what would it look like for you if one day you'd had enough and you finally made the choice that you're not going to be a good person anymore? And on that note, today's fiction. Impala by Lucas Coleman, read by the author. Rico was making his way up in the world. He rounded the bend and stopped just as the flashing red lights shot their fiery beams into the hot night air. It's not what made him think of sirens. Sirens were already on his mind, especially now, with what he was about to do. The dinging of the bells rang out hard and long as he stopped at the lights, and a train pulling an infinity of cars passed in front of him. When the ringing stopped and the red sirens finished flashing, he put his Chevy Impala into first and pulled forward, slow. It was quiet tonight, And on the nights he had to make deliveries, that's exactly how he liked it. Quiet, slow, uneventful. And when it was dark like this, it made things even easier. If anyone was nearby or watching, he'd be able to see signs that he wasn't alone. That was good. But he remembered Crook's warning. If things are chill and you ain't chill, you're looking left and right and darting your head around like a motherfucker. People gonna notice you ain't chill. Cops and shit. Best chill the fuck out and stop fucking around like a squirrely motherfucker. It was good advice, too. Although for the rest of the night, Crooks would refer to him only as Squirrel Motherfucker. Crooks took him on a delivery. His employee training. It was not only his interview, but his first day on the job. Kind of funny how the whole thing happened, actually. Rico was desperate for a job living just outside Las Cruces, New Mexico. It had been a long slew of bad jobs and shit deals. He was waiting tables at a Mexican restaurant whose owner made you turn over 70% of your tips. He went 8 weeks without a paycheck, and when he finally told the owner he wouldn't come back unless he was paid, the owner asked him squarely how he was going to sue him if he didn't have any money. He worked as a wedding DJ's assistant after that, but it was pretty clear the DJ was struggling to make ends meet himself and could only pay him 20 for what should have been an 8-hour day. It wasn't a hard gig, but he would happily work harder just to be able to eat more than once a day and something that wasn't on the dollar menu. He was a dog walker for an app, but taking the bus meant it just wasn't worth it to blah, 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 you get the idea. So one day, he was at Las Cruces Public Library, clicking on every Craigslist post he could, and of the hundreds of postings he applied to that day, he remembered this one the most. He remembered it because it didn't exactly seem like it was a job at all. At least not by the description, anyway. He clicked on a post titled, "Help Wanted." And all the ad said was, "Graveyard shift. No experience necessary. Email fkaldj8j3s8@yahoo.com. That was it. Didn't say anything about what the job was, but Rico was so desperate, he sent in a resume anyway. Sometimes, people can get lucky with posts like that. He had a friend who was looking for an apartment once, and he answered a pretty bare-bones ad on Craigslist that didn't include a photo. When his friend went to check the place out, it turned out to be the guest house of a mansion on about 10 acres of land. It belonged to some millionaire who was only there a couple weekends a year. He told his friend that if he rented the guest house, he could pay $200 a month, mostly for utilities, just because renting it out and having someone on the property full-time was cheaper than paying a security guard to watch the place. Rico thought about that story when he sent that email, and by the time he clicked refresh, he had already been given a reply. It was an address and a time. Sure, he should have been scared, but he was already scared of starving and being homeless. And besides, it didn't even make sense that this could be someone trying to trick him into robbing him. He obviously didn't have anything to steal, or he wouldn't be applying for such a desperate job in the first place. So he went to the address, another offshoot way outside the city. It was an enormous concrete building that was 75% of the way to being a new Costco or Walmart Supercenter or something like that, when the development lost funding and was abandoned entirely. It was too far off-grid for squatters to even hang out in. That's when he met Crooks. Rico walked his bike into the building. Crooks got out of the Impala that Rico now drove tonight through the train yard. "Hop in," Crooks said. And although Rico had no skills whatsoever, he did have a few instincts that he felt gave him too much of an edge to be as broke and hopeless as his youth had made him. He got the impression that Crooks was in the same boat as he was. The certainty he had to be mustered. Like maybe he was asked to be here by someone, and he also didn't have all the information. Driver said, he said, when Rico went toward the passenger seat. I don't have my license yet, Rico said, as though he were 16 and not a desperate 23-year-old who would likely never get a license. No ID? Crooks asked. When Rico nodded in disappointment, sure that this would ruin his chances of being hired, Crooks followed up with, That's probably better then. The two drove 4 hours that night, all the way to Elgin, Arizona, and all along the way, Crooks gave Rico the rundown. The gig itself was simple. You pick something up, you drive it to where you're told, you go home. Never ask a question, never tell anyone your real name, and above all else, you do not ever look at the cargo. One more thing you might be thinking, what do I do if I get my ass pulled over? You pulled over and you pray. That's it. You don't speed off, start a chase, none of that hero shit. Crooks continued the advice, little tips here and there about how to be inconspicuous, how to keep your head down, what to do if you're in a tight spot. When they got back to the abandoned Costco or Walmart Supercenter or whatever, just before dawn, Crooks popped the glove compartment, and sitting in it was an envelope filled with a stack of money. He didn't count it, just split it in half on what he assumed would be even, and handed it to Rico. He got out of the car and disappeared into the night. That was the last time Rico ever saw Crooks, and the first time in his adult life that he held $200 in his hands. It was all in 20s. The sad part was, even though he should have felt some relief, the first thing he did was started rationing it to himself in his mind. He can spend 5 on food for tonight. That would get him to tomorrow. Then 50 to go to his landlord just to buy him another few days before eviction. An act of good faith. It was a sad existence, but this new job seemed hopeful. He wondered how often he would be doing deliveries. Maybe one every few months. Maybe he would do this again tomorrow. Maybe he would get to keep the entire $400 next time. But one thing was for sure, he wouldn't dare ask. And then there was the question of the Impala. Crooks had left him with it, obviously so he could make more deliveries. And that's exactly what he did. So far, he had made 7 more over the course of 5 weeks, and the money was good. Better than good, as far as he was concerned. 420s every time. The pickup location was always different. He got that by email, always from a new email address, always a random series of letters and numbers. He pulled silently into an old train yard. He parked the car, turned off the headlights, took a black sack out of the back seat, and placed it over his head. His breath was hot as it wafted backward into his face. He heard the trunk open and the weight of something drop inside. The trunk door closed, but that didn't mean it was time to take the bag off his face. He heard the passenger door open, the glove compartment too. It closed, then the door closed. Then Rico gave it a few more minutes. When he took off the bag, warehouse was gone, and on the dash in front of him was a bar napkin with an address written on it. In the cup holder sat a cup of coffee. They never forgot the coffee, and they never gave him the address unless it was on a napkin. The coffee was cold. The first time Rico took the drive, he thought it was to keep him awake on the long journey. Maybe it went cold because he took too long to arrive for the pickup. Or maybe warehouse didn't give a fuck if his coffee was fresh or not. But then Rico realized if he got pulled over, he was supposed to put the napkin into the coffee cup. Goodbye address, and no one is the wiser where you're really headed. He waited several more minutes before starting the drive. Dryden, Texas. Jesus. Maybe 5 hours tonight. But that drive was south, and it wasn't on any major highways, so that was good. The pressure would be off, so long as he didn't go blazing through a small town with an asshole cop that had something to prove. He made good time that night, made it all the way to Marfa in no time flat, where the 90 runs right across the 67 like a snake in the road. He didn't listen to music or the radio when he was working. He was too focused for that. The amount of money that he was working for never left his mind, even though for the first time in his life, he had begun to flirt with the idea that things might turn out okay. He was courting hope, and he knew it was going to be a long engagement. Rico wasn't going to risk anything this nice over a mere curiosity of what might be playing on the remote town radios at the midnight hour. But when he passed the Love's truck stop, he saw the illuminated mart, and by God, you can't fight nature. He had to piss, and the brain-to-bladder fuse, now lit, was burning fast. He debated the luxury of making a rest stop, just a quick bathroom break. He didn't want to stop, never had before, but it would likely be another 2 hours until he reached the destination. He doubted he could make it another 30 minutes with the urine burning inside him like an ember. The thought of peeing in the car also crossed his mind, and he found it an appealing one. Nature calls. Fuck that. Duty calls, he thought. But then he thought better. If he kept driving, feeling like he was gonna burst, he might start speeding or looking twitchy on the road. What had been Crooks' advice? Best chill the fuck out and stop fucking around like a squirrely motherfucker. Those were wise words, and Rico pulled into the Loves. He played it cool, allowed himself to forget every aspect of his life. He leaned into the urge to piss. He wasn't about to get out of his car looking squirrely, especially at a truck stop where meth ran rampant. He went inside the truck stop and calmly strode to the restroom. He was ready to burst, but his chill performance could have won him a Golden Globe. The time he spent at the urinal seemed longer than the drive itself. Rico was experiencing one of those deceptive pees that seemed to go on forever, to where you can't imagine any organ being large enough to possibly hold that amount of liquid inside you. Halfway through his stream, he started to second guess if he had locked the car. Of course he had. He clicked the button on the key fob. But did the lights flash to indicate the car had in fact locked? They didn't flash on the Impala, or did they? Usually there was a little click that resonated from inside the car. Did he hear the click? He was sure he did. Or was he now imagining it? Hallucinating that he'd locked the car while in reality it was being robbed of its cargo and thrown into the back of a methed-up Trugger semi-truck and hauled away into the barren desert. A few drops of sweat skipped off Rico's forehead and joined his urine. He was sweating hard. Best chill the fuck out, he heard Crook's voice say, who had now become sort of an angel on his shoulder. Rico nodded his head yes to the voice in his head, and when he finally relieved himself once and for all, he zipped up, swung around, taking a deep breath of truck stop bathroom air, and noticed a highway patrol officer staring at him. He was at the sink at the far end, and he had been turned enough away from the sinks to indicate that he was addressing Rico, the squirrel, with his full attention. His face was blank. Rico imagined this to be his game face, and if he was wearing his game face, how long had he been observing Rico peeing and sweating like a motherfucker, twitching and shaking his head to nothing? The cop turned to the sink and resumed washing his hands, but Rico could still feel the cop's attention. He was listening, waiting. Rico played it cool through his paranoia. Maybe too cool of a transition, because now he looked like he was hiding something. He washed his hands, toweled off, and stole a glance for himself in the mirror. He was pooling sweat. dripping thick beads of cloudy, salty water down his nose. He toweled off the sweat casually and forced himself not to look at the cop. He was sure if he looked over again, even for a millisecond, and the cop was already watching him, that would be it. He went out into the mart and decided that it would be wise for him not to jump straight into the car. This cop might think he's on something and be ready to pull him over. So instead, he strolled the truck stop aisles, and as he walked through, he picked up little indulgences. A pepperoni stick, an off-brand sports drink called Bug Zap. He stood looking at the label of the lime green beverage while trying to reason what the hell was supposed to be so appetizing about it. He also grabbed a bag of Oreo Minis and a pack of Sour Patch Kids. It hurt him to assemble such a smorgasbord of treats, and Rico had to remind himself that this was okay. He was working now. He could afford it. And he didn't have to feel guilty for eating something that was meant to do more than purely sustain him until the next time he had the opportunity to eat again. When he was at the register, he started to feel the relief of getting back on the road. It was short-lived. The cop, emerging with a cup of coffee, stepped in line right behind him. Doom. They would check out at the same time, get into their cars at the same time. And if he started that engine but didn't pull away, the cop would know something was up. But Rico had good instincts, and he thanked his lucky stars that he could use them now. As the leathery cashier scanned the sweets and the pepperoni stick, Rico pointed behind him to the cigarettes. Pack of Marlboro Reds, up there. He didn't smoke. The luxury of that kind of a weekly expense seemed unfathomable. But he was a smoker today, at least until the cop got back on the road and out of sight before he started his Impala again. He bought a lighter and was lucky to think of it. And as he took his first ever puff, he saw the cop throw the cruiser in reverse and pull away. Shit, Rico said aloud. Maybe he wasn't following him after all. He thought about the paranoia and promised himself he would never let himself get that choked up in the moment again. He recalled some gangster film he'd seen. He couldn't remember which one, a black and white. Some wise-ass mobster was smirking and mocking a cop, all because he knew the law and he knew he was untouchable. The squirrel was never going to be that antagonistic, but it was some nice inspiration for keeping your wits about you. It was then that Rico remembered something else Crooks had said that night. Man, you ain't guilty till they throw that switch on the electric chair. He thought about this as he drove the next 40 miles. What was it exactly that he was transporting? The trick was not to think about it. The trick was to think about the money. The trick was to think about the appeased landlord. The trick was thinking about how in another month or two, you might be able to ask a girl out and not panic about the price of seeing a movie together. He assumed it was drugs. This close to the border, town to town, all the pieces fit. Maybe it was guns. A trunk full of rifles or pistols. Rico thought about how heavy this particular load had felt when it was dropped into the Impala's trunk. And maybe it was the pressure of the night's events, but he started to let his imagination wander away from him. He thought to himself, what if I'm transporting some sort of nuclear reactor across the state lines for some sort of secret government sector who was grooming me to be a new agent? And the idea made him feel warm inside, like the hollow pit within him had been slightly coated with a thin mucus of hope. He had nothing. Now he had something. It wasn't a purpose, per se. At the end of the day, he didn't even know what the fuck he was transporting. He was, for all intents and purposes, the world's shadiest Uber driver. but he felt like he was something, even if he couldn't tell a soul what that something was. He grabbed the pepperoni stick off the front passenger seat and peeled the two plastic sheath ends apart. He smelled it instantly. The thick American scent that flooded the car and his fingertips were lightly glazed with the meat oils from touching the insides of its wrapper. He took a bite and allowed himself to, at last, enjoy the finer things in life. A carefree trash treat that made every saliva gland in his mouth erupt. It wasn't ecstasy, but it was the best thing a truck stop had to offer that wouldn't leave you recklessly addicted or dying of AIDS. He took another hearty bite and started to chew, but when he heard it, he gasped so hard he sucked the pepperoni stick halfway into his lungs. "Hello?" he said loudly toward the back seat. "Help me," she repeated. She sounded young, like a toddler. Like a toddler who learned years too early what terror feels like. "Help," she said again, this time fainter, and the little girl began to weep from the trunk of the car. Rico threw the car to the side of the road and reminded himself that due to the child unseatbelted in the back of the trunk, he shouldn't slam on the brakes. He never once considered this might be the kind of cargo he'd been delivering. Kidnapping. But was he a kidnapper if he wasn't the one abducting the children? Would his ignorance constitute his innocence in this scenario? He felt a warm, thick rushing from his guts as he leaned into the passenger seat floorboard to vomit. The pieces of pepperoni stick, along with the McDonald's he relished in being able to afford earlier, landed on the floorboards in a sizzling heap. He had been taking children across state lines in his loaner car, and it all felt so cheap now. A few months ago, if you had asked him at his most desperate moment how much someone would have to pay him to deliver a kid across the border, no questions asked, he would have quoted you $1 million. And if you put $1 million in front of him, he would have handed it back and demanded $1 million more, and so on and so forth, until there literally wasn't enough money in the world. Yet here he was doing it all for the low price of $400 a kid. Or kids. What if there were more back there? Rico screamed to the child. "Are you all right? Please help me. I miss my mom," the girl shouted and then began to weep. Rico's heart broke. He felt tears begin to form in the corners of his eyes. He had lived in a state of panic, worry, and survival for so long, he'd forgotten that he was a human man capable of feeling all kinds of things, especially empathy. The red sirens blazed from the water that formed in the corners of his eyes. It wasn't a train warning this time. It was a squad car. It was directly behind him. And although the mirrors warn you that things may seem closer than they appear, this cop was so far up his ass he could practically shit a badge. Rico kept it cool and wiped the tears from his cheeks. He didn't piss himself, but that was only because he'd emptied his bladder about 45 miles back. The lights continued to flash, and he flicked on the radio for the first time that night. This is something he cooked up a few weeks back, and he couldn't believe that he'd remembered it now that the time for fast thinking had come. To Rico, driving in silence seemed suspicious. But if a cop sees you've got your engine idling and the radio blasting some John Denver, he'd think you're a regular pedestrian, minding your own business, enjoying your drive to God knows where, and not a threat to anyone at all. He could see the squad car doors opening behind him and recalled Crook's words like they were the Holy Bible. You pull over and you pray. That's it. You don't speed off, don't start a chase, none of that hero shit. Rico was not a hero, and no one had to convince him otherwise. He did, however, have one last unspoken task. He took the napkin and studied the address like his life depended on it. And his life did depend on it, in a way. He committed the napkin's address to heart. He dipped it into the cup of cold coffee and slipped the lid back onto it. When he looked up, the cop was tapping on his window. It was the cop, the one who had been watching him in the truck stop. And Rico had guessed that in his best efforts to play it chill, he had allowed the cop to follow him the entire time. His window rolled down slowly with the drawl of an early 2000s automation. "Shut the radio off, kill the engine," the cop said. And that was good. All this was, so far, within Rico's anticipation. But Rico knew that any second that voice from the trunk was going to shout for help, and the whole of the rest of his life would be over. He complied and waited for the cop's next instruction. But the cop just stood there, watching him, sizing him up. Rico heard a small thud from the boot of the Impala, like the kid kicked the side of the trunk, but the cop just stood there watching him. The cop must have heard it, but he just stood perfectly still, watching Rico. Or perhaps the thud happened in Rico's head, paranoia taking over. The cop was looking at his hands now, and Rico noticed they were shaking. He tightened his grip around the steering wheel, and they began to turn white at the knuckle.
"Where are you headed?"
"Dallas? My brother's getting married," Rico lied, anticipating the next question.
"License and registration."
Well, there it is. Rico couldn't get past phase one of this cop's interrogation because he had no license. And if this car was registered at all, which Rico seriously doubted, then it definitely wouldn't be to him. But Rico paused a moment. He was calculating in his mind how quickly he could throw the key into the ignition and take off into the night. He might get away, at least to a quiet alley somewhere where he could ditch the car and slip away into the night. He has the money from the glove box. That was more than enough to get him a bus ticket back over state lines. And this cop really had no idea who he was. The car couldn't even be traced back to him. But would he have time to start the engine and get away from the cop? Would the cop pull his gun and fire just for trying to run? Rico glanced again at the cop's face and thought to himself, yes, he would. He looked ready. This cop looked ready since they were in the truck stop. An exciting night in Cop Town, and the way this cop was tensing his jaw, he looked like he might even enjoy the thrill of the chase, the slow process of hunting down his prey before the kill. Rico's plan hatched from his brain egg. He would reach for the glove box and offer the cop the money that was waiting in there. By his reasoning, if the cop was corrupt enough to follow him around and chase him down like a dog, it might not be above him to accept a bribe either.
"I'm going to reach in the glove box and grab him," Rico said, and then instantly regretted it.
When you warn a cop you're about to go for the glove box, you're sort of telling him you've been down this road before, like you're a piece of shit who knows the drill. He clicked open the glove box and saw the little envelope that contains his money. He grabbed it, feeling the sweet weight of the cash relief in his hand. And as he pulled it towards himself, he saw something else that had lain beneath it. Rico hesitated as he pulled the little ID cards from the glove compartment. It had his face on the California driver's license, but it didn't say Rico. It said Jamie Paul Bennett. The insurance card had the same name. What the hell? The people he worked for, they had made this for him. For just such an emergency as this. For the love of God. They are all for anonymity, but Jesus, could they not have afforded to tell him about the fake ID cards? And what's weirder is that Rico didn't know how they got these photos of him. He didn't have a social media or any pictures of himself posted on the internet. He'd never let them take a photo of him before. He'd never even met these people or seen their faces for that matter. And when he was in the warehouse, he always had a black sack covering his face. So where did they get it? He passed the cards to the cop, who told him to stay put. The cop went back to the squad car to run his ID. Rico waited, feeling like his seams were splitting. But when the cop returned, he tossed him back his cards and told him, "Have a good night." That couldn't possibly be right. It's one thing to make a fake ID, but to make one functional enough to fool the police department? Had they created an entire fake identity for him as well? Rico wondered again about the people he was working for, the Impala and the rundown warehouses. He assumed this organization to be the same quality. The way they communicated was so archaic, so off-grid and untraceable, but now he wondered if that was a testament to their brilliance. Every layer being meticulously planned, and Rico was sitting at the very bottom of it all. The cop was walking back towards his cruiser when another knock sounded from the trunk. This time, the cop did hear it, and he turned to Rico. "Step out of the vehicle," he commanded. Rico got out, and the cop yanked him by the shoulder, reaching for his cuffs. "Got someone back there?" "No," Rico said, trying to sound surprised, but coming off more like a dipshit. And instantly, the little voice cried out again. "Help me!" Like the cracking of a whip, the cuffs landed around Rico's wrists. He had lost his chance to flee. The cop, now losing composure and feeling rushed, threw Rico to the ground and grabbed the keys from the front seat. He traced around to the back of the Impala as he shouted to the child, "It's all right. I'm a police officer. I'm going to get you out." The cop popped the trunk and shouted, looking more stressed, turning back to the Impala's key ring. "Which key is it?" he shouted to Rico. "What? Which key opens the trunk?" "The trunk is open," Rico shouted back, confused. "Not the car's trunk. The old one. The trunk inside the trunk." And the cop made his way back toward Rico. He slammed him against the pavement, and Rico felt a thick, wet ooze seeping from the back of his hair. "Where's the trunk keys? Jesus! There aren't even any air holes in it!" He grabbed Rico by the nape of his neck and dragged him toward the car's trunk. "Open the fucking trunk!" he said, slow and direct, into Rico's ear, and then he slammed his teeth directly into the trunk's hard metal edge, shattering three of them. The child, from inside the trunk, something that looked like it was built hundreds of years earlier, started to panic weep. Rico didn't know at which point he should start explaining that he had no idea there was a child in the car, but he felt like this was not it. The cop brought his head down another time, costing him another two of his front teeth. The root became exposed, and Rico mercifully started to pass out from the pain. But the cop steadied him with a hard slap to the side of his cheek. "I don't know," Rico cried. And he cried it like a baby. "I don't know anything. Oh, open the fucking trunk," the cop said in an attempt to better his grip on Rico's hair. But in the process, he accidentally pulled out a fistful of it. "I don't know, I don't know. I didn't even know there was a kid in there. I don't know. I'm going to ask you one more fucking..." But before he could finish his demand, Rico had spit a thick wad of blood into the cop's face. Maybe it was that gangster film. Maybe he felt like nobody should have the right to lay into him like this, cop or otherwise. Or maybe he was just wondering where cops, the government, or any of this help was when he was the one that needed it, struggling and starving and desperate to keep a roof over his head. Why should he be good? He thought through the pain and misery and embarrassment and fear. Good doesn't put food on the table. You can't pay your rent with goodness.
Good won't keep you warm in the winter. And if he gets sent to hell for all of this when it's said and done, at least the heat will be on and there'll be a roof over his head. Rico had never been so fucked up in his entire life. The cop was relentless. And just before the seventh blow, just before his jawbone fractured, Rico had an idea. He would answer the cop.
Wait.
The keys behind the trunk, Rico wept. He didn't know where the key was, but it was going to give him a chance to get out of this. And this time around, he wasn't going to hesitate. Wasn't going to be a pawn anymore. Rico was making his way up in the world. The cop, having thrown all sense of protocol out the window upon commencing Rico's beatdown, reached awkwardly behind the trunk. At least it sort of looked like a trunk. Rico wasn't so sure now, but the cop reached forward with both outstretched hands, struggling to get through the tight fit. And handcuffed or not, it gave Rico time to slip the little taser off the cop's waistband and give him a shock that resonated with a repeated clicking sound throughout his entire body. The cop fell backwards onto the asphalt, twitching. Little gurgling sounds escaped from his throat. "What do I do if I get my ass pulled over?" Rico thought he heard Crook's words replay in his mind. "You pull over and you pray. That's it. You don't speed off. Start a chase. None of that hero shit."
"Well, Crooks, that might be how you want to play it, but we all have our styles."
Rico took the keys from the cop's belt and uncuffed himself. Then he grabbed the cop's gun, held it to the cop's head, and pulled the trigger. At least he tried to. The safety was on. He looked at the gun with puzzlement, flicked the little button beside the trigger, cocked it, which he realized as he was doing was totally unnecessary and only from movies that he felt the need to, and unloaded a bullet into the police officer's head. He had noticed that the voice in the trunk had stopped weeping from the moment he'd spit in the cop's face. Strange. Maybe the child had run out of air. All the screaming had caused him to use the last of the trunk's oxygen. Maybe he was too scared to shout. Rico looked at the mess he'd made. He knew he didn't have long. Someone in a car would drive along and see what he'd done. And the police cruiser, which most assuredly had some sort of GPS, would eventually be checked in on if this officer didn't call the station. There was no cleaning this up or trying to hide it, and he had spat a fat wad of blood into the face, mouth, and eyes of this officer, so his DNA as a cop killer would be marked until the end of time. He only had one place to go. That was clear. He had a delivery to make. It was his only exit strategy. As he walked to the trunk of the Impala and reached up to close it, the lock, a big old-fashioned iron thing that looked like it'd be used more to close castle gates rather than to lock this strange leather and steel child-sized box, suddenly clicked open. Had the cop actually found the skeleton key and been able to get it open? Impossible. It had opened on its own, and Rico decided he wanted to have a look. Worst thing that could happen is the kid inside gets a little fresh air. He lifted the lid to the leather and steel trunk, and when he looked inside, there wasn't a kid there at all. Just something that looked like an iron bracelet with a beetle on it. It looked old and kind of stupid, Egyptian hieroglyphic old, but had the crudeness of a tool used in the gold rush. Rico let out one small singular laugh. After all that, what had he been transporting? Some piece of shit
probably stolen from a museum or traveling show, only to be sold later on eBay, antique. He should have just let the cops see the thing. Either of them wouldn't have known what it was they were looking at. He picked up the beetle bracelet and felt the unbelievable weight of it in his palm. Suddenly, the little steel legs of the beetle began to squiggle and squirm, and the beetle bit into Rico's right hand. He felt rust squeeze out of its little iron fangs and flood his veins. In an instant, Rico could feel from the inside of every ounce of blood in his body, the broken teeth sprouted blood as thick as oil, and his teeth started to grow back. Not only did they grow back, but they were growing longer and finer than before. The nerve endings danced and bloomed like cauliflower throughout the tooth, and the narrow splits in his busted lip hugged one another and weaved like roots throughout his face. The pain was gone. His whole body felt lively, like a burning sensation coursing throughout. His skin grew taut everywhere. He felt the skin on his knuckles slowly split and then burst open. But the piercing was pleasant and warm. Small bones in his hands had sharpened and penetrated through the skin of the knuckle. When he sat down in the passenger seat, he caught the corner of his face in the rearview mirror, but he didn't bother to point it at himself and get a better look. Not because he was afraid, but because he didn't care. He was something else now. He didn't have the napkin with the delivery address on it, but he didn't need it. And when he arrived back at the warehouse, he didn't bother to place the black bag over his head. It was all right if they saw him now, because now he saw them for what they really were, and he knew that he looked just like them. He wouldn't be a driver anymore. He parked the Impala for the last time and got out, walking the room in a slow circle, the bones penetrating through the skin of his feet, clicking and echoing off the hollow concrete walls with every step. Rico was finally making his way up in the world. Well, folks, I hope that you get everything you want this Christmas. I got everything I wanted, and that was to get through a recording of this podcast without my cats interrupting me several thousand times. We got it down to a few hundred, and I'll take it. If you would like to give California Gothic something this year, what you can do is you can share our podcast with others. Go ahead and text it to everyone you've known. Send it to an old boss as a warning. Forward it on Instagram or Apple Podcasts or Spotify to those who are emotionally vulnerable that you wish to exact your revenge upon. Play it with your family before they fall asleep in front of the fire beneath the Christmas tree, just before you nestle upstairs to where the parents of the household can then simulate a home invasion by a fantastic monster named Santa Claus. Light a candle for those in need. Definitely give me money. Go out into the woods in the middle of the night to see if you can spot the star that is swirling around orbit, bringing us all to a closer centrical line of thinking that'll ignite joy throughout our souls as we connect with the cruel, unfeeling consciousness of the universe and offer it something that it'll bring mercy to your family when the final hour approaches. And other than that, have a happy holiday. I'm Lucas Coleman. This is California Gossip. Tune in for a new episode and a new season. When will it be? Well, I wouldn't want to ruin the surprise. Would you?